Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and me, Tris Dixon. Delighted to be joined by two of the voices of British boxing. I was going to say of this generation, but really any generation. John and Ian, it's great to have you. And today we are going to talk about the Fab Four, no less, which are, in most people's books, Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvin Hagler, Roberto Duran, and Tommy the Hitman Hearns. Ian, because you predate John and myself, let's kick off with you. You actually saw some of these incredible fighters and some of their incredible fights.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about it now, and probably if you're under the age of 50, 55, you never did see those fighters, and you're probably thinking, oh, here they are banging on about the past again. But, you know, if you want to put it into this era, imagine a situation where you had AJ, Tyson Fury, Usyk, Wilder, all guaranteed to fight against each other at some point in their careers, roughly when they were sort of at their peak as well. So that's what you had, probably with a lot of gloss thrown in back in the 1980s with Marvin Hagler, Thomas the Hitman Hearns, Sugar Ray Leonard, and Roberto Hands of Stone Duran, all with a charisma of their own. And if you look at the series that they produced, it produced probably the greatest round in history, Hagler and Hearns' first round. One of the biggest stories in history, Roberto Duran turning his back on Sugar Ray Leonard, the no mass fight. Three fantastic fights. Leonard Hearns won the showdown. Hagler Hearns, the first Leonard Duran fight. So it was an intoxicating time, and it was a very important time for boxing as well, because it came just after Muhammad Ali had sort of left the scene, and boxing needed that, and it was absolutely great that those fighters got it on and, thank goodness, made a lot of money together.
John, did you have a preference for any of those fighters, any of the four? Was there one that you particularly admired?
Well, I was a Sugar Ray Leonard fan, massively so, as a young lad. You know, we'd seen him at the Olympics, winning the gold medal in 1976, and then when he came through as a professional, he wasn't actually. He said at the time that after winning that gold medal, that was going to be it. He was never going to be a professional, but he decided to be a fighter because he was broke, basically, and he'd got a young kid, and he needed to find a way of making some money, and boxing was the way he did it. But he didn't actually, as a boy coming up as an amateur, I don't think he saw himself long term fighting for a living. He was intending to go away and do his studies. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I was a massive fan of his. He had speed, he had movement, he was very, very quotable, a very good interviewee, terrific on television, and he produced some fabulous performances, didn't he? I mean, but having said that, I think, you know, you talk about great fights. I thought that the first Roberto Duran Sugar Ray Leonard fight in Montreal, was this in 1979, with the one which Duran won, I thought that was an extraordinary fight. And on that night, Duran, who arguably is one of the best, if not the best, lightweights of all time, he was just sensational that night.
Yeah, and that was Leonard's ego, really, that night. Sugar Ray Leonard, with all that talent, all that speed, blurring hand speed that he had, and an amazing skill set. But his ego was huge. And he thought, having been wound up by Roberto Duran in the build-up to that fight and being told he was a sissy and a pitter-pat puncher and all that kind of thing. He got goaded rather naively by Duran into having a bust-up with him and going toe-to-toe with him. And Leonard was trying to say to him, you know what? I won't just beat you the way I can beat you. I'll beat you your way as well. Well, he couldn't. He couldn't beat Duran that way. And Duran was a convincing winner of that fight. But it was a spectacular occasion. Of course, they fought again. And this time, Leonard did what he should have done the first time, just use his boxing skills and totally dispirited Duran, who turned his back on him. Amazingly, really, given the macho reputation of Duran. I couldn't believe that when I saw that. Him just turn his back and say, no mass, no more, at the beginning of the eighth round. He claimed he had stomach cramps, but Ray Alcell, the great trainer who was working in his corner, said, no, he quit on me. No boxer ever quit on me. He needs a psychologist.
They yeah, didn't, I mean, I mean, you said, obviously, about the first fight. I think Duran went so far as to even taunt Ray Leonard's wife, Juanita, didn't he, to, you know, in terms of the mind games. And then, sorry, John, you were saying there about the no massing. It's astonishing now, and I'm butting in, but John, you pick it up from here, that the no mass fight, you think of the label quitter in boxing today, it's one of the worst terms you could have. But Duran, all these years on, people don't call him a quitter, do they?
No, I mean, the words used are disputed, aren't they? There are people who say he actually didn't say no mass, that there was more to it than that. You know, and he was being taunted. If you remember the fight, he was being taunted by Leonard, wasn't he? Leonard was boxing him and he was talking to him in the ring. He was sticking his tongue out. And apparently, you know, he's quoted by some sources saying there was a bit more than no mass. He just said, I don't want to fight with this clown anymore. And he was just, for a man like Duran, it wasn't what he saw boxing as being about. You know, he'd been well pissed off in the run-up to the first start fight, the fact that Sugar Ray Leonard was reportedly getting five times the money that he was. And he was a guy who was he 70-1 at the time? His record was extraordinary, and he didn't think he was valued, and so I think there was more to it than just turning his back. But it was a long time before he really got his reputation back as being this hard man, this wild man of the ring.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Leonard always outscored his opponents in terms of money. His path was always paved with gold after he'd won the Olympic gold medal. I think he got $45,000 for his professional debut. So it was always like that with him. And yeah, you could understand other fighters. And let's bring Hagler into the conversation here, because Hagler had completely the opposite, didn't he? He all through his career in the early days, he was like president of the Who Needs Him Come club. People knew how good he was. He got sidetracked. He got ignored. He was on the wrong end of a pretty dodgy decision when he first fought for the world middleweight title against Vito Antuofermo. They called it a draw. Hagler won the fight. So he always had that big chip on his shoulder, Hagler. So, I mean, that was what made it, you know, so enticing and exciting, that difference in personality and background when they did eventually fight right at the end of the Four Kings era in 1987.
Do you remember when Hagler fought Willie the Worm Munro early in his career? First time he fought him at short notice and lost on points. Then he won a rematch, a knockout in the 12th round. Third time they fight, fought the rubber match, he knocked him out in two rounds. Now, Willie Munro had Joe Frazier looking after him at that time, and Frazier was quoted as saying, there are three things about you. You're black, you're a southpaw, and you're good. In other words, people ain't going to want you unless you continue just tearing people apart.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so when he came to London, having had that draw with Antofermo and got another shot at the title against Alan Mintram. We've spoken in other episodes of this podcast about everything surrounding that fight, with Alan Minter reportedly saying, "I'm not going to lose my title to a black man." And I think he had a few racists as well among his fans. I mean, it ended the night in a riot. But you could tell Hagler's mood even before that fight, when he waltzed into London wearing a pinstripe suit and gave a very, very classy address to the media about he'd heard everything that had been said, and his job was just to go there and do his job in the ring, and make no mistake about it, he was going to do it. And I sat at ringside, probably only 5 feet from Hagler, and every punch he threw that night had devil in it. I think one of the early punches kind of bust open the cheek of Minter. He was hitting him so hard just with jabs, and you knew within 30 seconds he's not going to be able to live with this guy. I mean, and Minter was pumped up that night as well, maybe wrongly pumped up. He wasn't maybe so smart, and he maybe got just enticed into going toe-to-toe with him, and he definitely came off second best. It only lasted 3 rounds, and you know, Alan got busted up that night. It was his considerable misfortune to run into Hagler in that kind of mood, and, you know, that was the start of a 7-year reign, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think the Hagler thing is really interesting, John, in the sense that you mentioned Willie the Worm Monroe, but he had a whole education in Philadelphia where he fought the likes of Benny Briscoe and Cyclone Hart, and he was there. Those guys were all terrors, and they had Boogaloo Watts, and there was a real era of middleweights in Philly, and those guys were sort of desperate to see who was the best in the city. And then Hagler came and basically, you know, ended up beating them all in some way, shape, or form. And that was, as much as anything, his education. But sorry, John, I interrupted.
Well, no. It's all very relevant. I mean, he was the archetypal, if you like, blue-collar champion, wasn't he? He didn't have, until later in his career, after he'd beaten Kevin Finnegan. I think that was when Bob Arum got on board. But early in his career, there's no way he was a chosen one. He couldn't have been more different from Sugar Ray Leonard. He did it by dint of his performances and by being a hard, hard man and a damn good fighter. You know, he never got the silver spoon in boxing terms, did he?
No, he didn't. But, you know, I'm just thinking, you mentioned Leonard, and I've said that. Yeah, he did have his path paved with gold all the way through. But he really had to work the night he won the welterweight title for the first time against Wilfred Benitez. That was a heck of a battle, you know, and it went to within, I think, 6 seconds of the end before Leonard stopped. It was at that point, you know, a multi-talented operator, and I think he made Leonard miss probably more than Leonard ever missed in any fight in his career.
Yeah, they called Benitez the radar.
1979, wasn't it, that one? And then he came off that and smashed poor old Dave Boy Green.
Well, he was big mates with Dave Boy Green. He really kind of befriended Dave Boy Green before the fight. He just took a shine to him. I don't know why. And I think he got it in his head that, you know, I'm going to make this quick. It's not going to be, I'm not going to make him suffer for 12 rounds here. And that's exactly what he did. I mean, it was a massive lights out punch. And I think it was the fourth round. And I think Dave Boy Green was out of there before he even touched the canvas. So, I mean, they remain good mates. It's a nice story. The old Fen Tiger and Sugar Ray Leonard.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Ian, was Hagler on the radar of any of these guys when they were lightweights and welterweights? Do you think, was he even in the conversation at the early 80s that he was going to wind up in the mix with these guys?
No, probably not. They kind of all grew up, didn't they, into his division. So, you know, Duran, as John was saying, was regarded by many people as the greatest lightweight of the 20th century. He obviously made an impact at higher weights as well. You know, Leonard and Hearns had met in that great showdown fight in 1981, where he turned it round. I mean, what an amazing fight that was, as well, as part of this series. It looked like Hearns was on his way to winning the fight. But I remember Angelo Dundee had said beforehand, Sugar Ray Leonard's trainer, he said, "You know what? People have got this wrong. My guy's the puncher in this fight." And after the 12th round with Leonard behind, I mean, he famously said, it's part of boxing folklore now, he famously said to Leonard, "You're blowing it, kid." And Leonard went out, and from that point, threw a fusillade of punches and got the job done in the 14th round, turned it all around. Another memorable fight. And what was great about that is they were both bang at their peak, Hearns and Leonard. You just don't get that much these days. And Leonard prevailed there as well. But yeah, you know, they kind of all, it became a natural. There was so much charisma around Hagler himself. I mean, I was frightened of him just looking at him coming in the ring underneath that hood. Those films of him running along the beach saying destruction and destroy to the cameras, you know, it frightened you. And so I think they were always heading in his direction, to answer your question, Tris. And you know, that led to not only the Leonard fight, but when Hearns came up through the divisions and then he went into Hagler's territory, didn't he, and fought him at middleweight. And well, it was just explosive.
Do you think there's an argument, Ian, that Tommy Hearns' first time round got Leonard maybe just a little bit too early in his career? And then, of course, when he fought him second time, I think most people who saw that fight thought that Tommy had been sawn off. They thought that he won that fight, but didn't get the decision.
Yeah, I think that fight came sort of too late then. It was 1989, that second fight, and they were both, you know, it was beyond the Leonard fight for Hagler. So it wasn't such a relevant occasion. The fight that really mattered was 1981, the one they called the Showdown, which was a spectacular affair. But it was interesting, Hagler-Hearns. I don't think I've ever experienced an atmosphere around a fight like that. It was open air, Caesar's Palace, big crowd, expensively dressed, you know, and a feeling that something special was going to happen. I remember the fight being delayed and us sitting there on this balmy evening waiting for this fight to enter the ring. And you know, nobody could believe the first round of it. It is, I think most people agree, the greatest round of boxing ever. And I think I've told the story about getting the letter from the amateur boxing trainer in Kent, who'd heard my commentary on the radio of it, and said, "You didn't talk about which punches got parried and slipped." And so I wrote him a very nice letter back saying thanks for his interest. But I think when he viewed the fight, he might see that not too many punches were parried or slipped in the
I was one of your listeners for that one, Ian. I wasn't actually there at that fight. It was before I was working for radio down in London. So I was one of your listeners. And I always remember Harty, Colin Hart, who'd been a boxing writer for The Sun forever. And yeah, come the end of that first round, he was almost literally speechless, wasn't he? He couldn't put any words together for a few seconds to describe what he'd seen.
Yeah, well remembered, John. He couldn't. There was a sort of, if you listen back to the tape of that, there's like a 3 or 4 second break at the end of the round with me and Colin, yeah, words sticking in his throat like, "I don't believe what I've just seen. That is the greatest." his voice, I mean, it was great because his voice told the story of how special it was. And of course, there was that other great line in that fight, because Hagler got cut, didn't he? And Richard Steele, who was the referee, went over to his corner at the end of the second round of the fight and said, Marvin, "You're cut. Can you see okay?" And Hagler went, "I ain't missing, am I?"
It was extraordinary, wasn't it? And yeah. You know, I mean, if that fight had been now, there would instantly have been rematch clauses and people would have been talking about, let's do this again. And there must have been some momentum for that, and yet it never happened.
Yeah, it never happened. And I think it's because Hagler won it so decisively in the end. And I think what he was saying to Hearns and why the fight was so great was Hearns had this reputation of being an absolutely devastating, chilling, lights-out puncher. But he was moving into Hagler's division, moving up. And Hagler was basically saying to him, I think, "Look, if you want to have this L, if you think you're the big puncher, welcome to my division. This is, I'm the king here, and I've been the king in this division for 5 years. So let's see what happens if you try and take me on in a fight like that." So that's why you got the first round that you got. with them both just blasting away with both barrels, and how it went on in that way. And Hagley was the naturally bigger guy at that time. He prevailed. His punches were accurate and lacerating, and you know, he started to knock it out of Hearns, and you know, the end came in the third round. I mean, it was only 8 minutes. It was 8 minutes of fury, but it's 8 minutes that will never ever be forgotten.
I think one of the things that you remember about that fight, though, again, which I think this is massively to Tommy Hearns' credit, we found out afterwards, and he never revealed it at the time, that he bust his hand in the first round. And he never said, he never came out with any sort of excuse, did he? It was later when that got into the public domain.
Yeah, I mean, I always liked Hearns. He was a kind of a big, tall, gangling guy who giggled a lot. I remember you'd never think he was that ferocious in the ring when you sat down and talked to him. He was quite softly spoken, and he didn't really have too much of the bracket around him, and just went about his business. I mean, he was a likable guy, and I'm sure he still is.
You could argue he was Manny Stewart's masterpiece, couldn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when he first turned up in the gym, he was a technical fighter, wasn't he? And it was Manny and his training at Kronk that turned him into this feared puncher.
I think Tris will confirm this, but I think, Tris, you're better at this kind of stuff than us two. I think as an amateur, he only had about 8 knockout wins in something like 155 contests. So, yeah, they obviously turned him into this big concussive hitter.
Yeah, and they matched him tough. He fought the likes of Aaron Pryor and some huge, huge matches out there in the States. And like you said, he just became this absolute destroyer. Ian, let me ask you this. We talked about Hagler, the fighter, and his like hard upbringing in the fight game. Did he have a chip on his shoulder when you dealt with him?
Dealing with him wasn't easy because obviously we've got other things to do. So he would turn up in fight week, and this was true of the American writers as well. Hagler would not do interviews in the week of the fight. So you could go up to Goody Petronelli, his trainer, and ask, could we talk to Marvin? And he'd say, you know what Marvin's like, you know, in his new England accent. He goes, he ain't going to talk to you guys. It's a championship fight. So I turned out when he fought Tony Simpson, and it was like 4 days to go, and his entourage arrived at the hotel. And my producer, a lady called Emily McMahon, said, look, we've come all this way. We need to get an interview with him. And I said, well, agreed. She said, you've got to ask him. So I wandered up to him in reception at the hotel. And I said, sorry to bother you, Marvin. He goes, what do you want? I said, I'm from the BBC in England. He went, congratulations. What do you want? I said, well, we've come all this way to cover your fight with Tony Simpson. You know, he's obviously from England. I said, I just wonder if we could have just a couple of minutes of your time for a quick interview just to help us preview the fight. He goes, it's the week of a championship fight, isn't it? I said, yes. He goes, I don't talk to anybody in the week of a championship fight. He said, I like the BBC, but I'm not talking to you. And walked off. And so that was that. good. So his trainer came up to me afterwards. Petronelli came up to me and said, you know what? He said, I saw what happened there. He goes, you were very polite with Marvin, and thanks for being so understanding. And we're going to make sure you get the first interview after the fight. I said, well, I'll keep you to that. So he's beaten Simpson, and I'm right against deadline now. I've got to file a piece for a program called Sport on 4. And I've only got about half an hour to do it in. So I thought, okay, I go to Hagler's dressing room after the fight, and there's policemen, about 12 of them, guarding the door. So I walk up and I flash my credentials. I said, Ian Dark from the BBC, they're expecting me. To my amazement, the policemen all just parted and let me into the dressing room. I go in the dressing room, and Hagler, with not a stitch of clothes on, is walking across to have a shower. The two Petronelli brothers are sitting there on the zone. They said, what do you want? And I said, Ian Dark from the BBC, you remember you promised me the first interview after the fight. They all burst out laughing and said, "So we did." And Hagler goes, "Hey, let's sit down and do this." He didn't go and shower. He came and sat down without a stitch of clothing on me, did this great interview for about 4 minutes, saying, you know, he forgave the British fans now. He realized what had happened. It was just a minority of idiots that night at Wembley. You know, he realized there were real fight fans in England and how much they appreciated him and how, you know, brave Simpson had been and all that. I mean, I got this great interview, walked out, and I mean, it's quite a story. But generally speaking, I mean, he was a lovely bloke away from fights. He was quite a good laugh, in fact. But anywhere near a fight, don't go near him.
So, sorry, let me clarify this, Ian. When you say not a stitch of clothing, do you mean a towel or nothing?
No, nothing. He was wearing absolutely nothing. He was just going to shower as I walked in the room.
So you interviewed dude Marvin Hagler?
Exactly that. For radio, of course. It was for radio, you know. So, not an issue. I mean, the listeners to BBC Sport on 4 that morning would have had no idea the circumstances.
Well, I think we may as well wrap the podcast up because we're not going to better that, are we?
You know, that story. Yeah.
John, unless you've interviewed Sugar Ray Leonard in the nude, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I'm interested in anything else you've got to say.
Well, the only nude thing I can give you is Sugar Ray Leonard's last fight, which was against Camacho, and Camacho, who was a bit of a wild man, as you know, he was once arrested on the fast lane of a freeway for apparently performing some sort of sexual act, actually while he was driving. But he was weighing in for that contest. It was coming live on ESPN, and the fight was made at middleweight, and there was no way that Camacho was going to be tight at the weight. He goes up to the scales. This is on live television. Takes absolutely everything off and stands there in front of the camera with his little willy waving for all. Gets on and he promptly weighs in 6 pounds inside the limit.
6 pounds?
Well, something like that. 4 pounds, maybe. But he was way inside the limit. All he wanted to do was take all his clothes off on national television.
Okay, John, you're back in the game, mate. You're back in the game.
Not quite as good.
But I tell you what, obviously we talk about Hagler and obviously the chip on his shoulder, but Leonard was not like that to the media, was he? He came across as a much more manicured brand. Is that right, Ian?
Correct. I mean, the dealing I had with Leonard that I remember, and apologies if I've covered this story before, was... I mean, you remember the huge controversy about the decision in the Hagler-Leonard fight, and I've never known a fight which divided opinion among really good judges quite as much as that one. You know, some people you really respected thought Hagler had won it. Other people you respected just as much thought Leonard had won it. So, you know, a couple of years later, and he's working for HBO, and I'm in Atlantic City, still working on the radio, and I give a call to his room. I heard what hotel he's staying. They put me through. He picked up the phone and I said, it's Ian Dark here from the BBC in London. I'm just wondering if I could do a quick radio interview with you at some point today. And he said, "Did you see my fight against Hagler?" I said, "Yep." He goes, "Who won? How did you score it?" I said, "Well, I had you winning it by 115-113. Be here at 4:30, room 487. I'm pretty sure if I'd said, you know, "I don't know, I'm not sure, it was a bit, you know, or I think my Hagler might have nicked it," there wouldn't have been an interview. So that was how much ego that I think Leonard had still, and it irked him that some people thought that he hadn't won that fight. Some people, obviously respected people in the business. I remember asking him in that fight, I said, why do you keep doing this? You keep retiring, Ray, and you keep coming back again. You know, you've made your money. Your health's great. Why do you keep doing it? Is it ego, glamour, money?" And he just said, "All three of those."
How was the interview, Ian? Was he easy to talk to?
Yes, very. I mean, it was like John said, he was very, very articulate and very helpful and knew the business and very bright.
Did you get at all, you know, this was you, I know you'd obviously done Muhammad Ali, Larry Holmes and been around several years by this point, but were you at all starstruck? Were you looking at these guys thinking, you know, I'm working with generational talents here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you are a little bit, if we're honest, and you, we work with, you know, huge names in boxing. I mean, you're aware that you are talking to somebody that most people would give their right arm to do it. But you know what it's like because you've done it yourself, Tris, and you, John, as well. You, a professional thing kicks in. You're there and you should be sort of on an equal level to ask relevant questions on behalf of your viewers or listeners or whatever it is. So, you know, yeah, you wouldn't wander in there asking for their autograph or anything like that. You go in and you do your job professionally. I mean, I remember interviewing Bob Arum about these four much, much later, this era, the Four Kings, the great era. And I said, which one did you like dealing with most? And he said, well, it wouldn't be Hagler, he said, because he said if he was coming into town, I was getting the next plane out. He said about the fight. He said Leonard could be difficult in the negotiations. Hearns he liked, but Duran was the best. He said if Duran won, said, and he usually did, he said we'd go to the restaurant and he would buy everybody in the restaurant the meal that night. Didn't matter if there were like 80 people in there, he would pay for the meal and say, everything's on me here tonight, I've won. He said
sounds like John with his BBC expenses.
Absolutely. once upon a time, and that was the case. I was fond of Duran. He kind of had a rehabilitation, didn't he, in that fight against Hagler. You know, he gave him a real argument. What was it, 13 rounds before Hagler mm-hmm. finally did him. But I mean, he was never really truly a middleweight, was he? And yet he produced that performance. And then when we thought that he'd just about finished in 1989, by that stage he's 37 years old. Iran Barclay's beaten Tommy Hearns, you know, he's kind of introduced himself as this hard man of the division. And do you remember, Ian, Roberto Duran went and won it, and it was the night before one of the big heavyweight fights. It might have been the Bruno fight, Bruno Tyson, and we watched it in the bar, and I think all of us had backed Duran at about 3-1 against, and by goodness, weren't we a happy lot to see him win.
Yeah. I mean, he had a kind of comeback win as well, didn't he, against Davey Moore? Do you remember that? And he sort of we kept on writing him off. I mean, he lost to Kirkland Lang, didn't he? He was a gifted fighter, but, you know, couldn't concentrate and had lost twice to Colin Jones, British, you know, welterweight. And Kirkland Lang beating him when he was a little bit out of shape, Duran. Still a great win by Kirkland. Well, you know, you can never take that away from him. But, you know, he came back from that as well. And he had that sort of dark, satanic kind of look about him, didn't he, Duran? Yeah. And he had fantastic, you know, that Latino, you know, machismo thing going on around him, and it was incredible to be around him and his entourage as well. I mean, one of the stories about Duran was that he was with some of the American fight writers and who'd gone out to Panama to see him to do some kind of feature about him, and he took him for a walk along the beach, and he said they call this Duran Beach. And they said, why do they call it Duran Beach? And he goes, because anyone I don't like, I kill them. But it was all part of his kind of, he knew what his image was and how to play to it a little bit too.
Did you ever see him skip rope? Do you ever see him on the skipping rope? I've never seen any fighter who was better with a rope than Roberto Duran. He was just amazing. And he could still do that when he was over 40. You know, I mean, he was just sensational on that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned there about Duran being in and out of shape. And Ian, you also had said about Leonard's negotiations. Well, there's a couple of things there. The sort of Leonard's negotiations, in some ways, if you want to look at the business side of things, with, what was it, Mike Trainor, who was with Leonard? Leonard's ability at the negotiating table, in many ways, defined the era, didn't it? Because if you think, you know, he sort of tried to call all the shots with Hagler. Didn't he invite Hagler to a press conference where he thought Hagler was going to announce the fight, and then he retired in front of Hagler and played mind games with him. And then if you remember that fight, the second fight we've talked about with between Duran and Leonard, the no mass fight, Duran was dining out on that first victory, and Leonard made a quick foray to get the rematch while he knew Duran was out celebrating. Duran had put on all the weight, and then he had to crash it off because Leonard wanted an immediate rematch.
I think Dave Jacobs, who was part of the team around that time, actually quit the camp, didn't he, for a while, because he thought Leonard was making a mistake going for an immediate rematch with Duran. It proved to be the right decision by Leonard. He must have been that's certain. But I do think he had that. I mean, the psychology was a big thing with Leonard. He wanted to be the boss of the mind games as well. I remember after that no-mass fight with Duran, and he made a remark to one of the journalists. He said, you know what? He said, making him quit was better than knocking him out. So I think he always wanted to feel like he'd had the upper hand, which is probably why it irked him so much that quite a few good judges thought that he didn't beat Hagler in that fight. He wanted everybody to acknowledge that he really was the king of the four kings.
I bet if you talk to him now, he'd still bridle about that. You know, you talk about respected judges. You know, a lot of us who were around at that time used to admire the writing of Hugh McIlvany. Hughie had it to Hagler by four rounds. A four-point margin.
Yeah, and the scoring, I looked this up, was Moretti 115-113 to Leonard, Filippo 115-113 to Hagler, and then Jose Guerra. I mean, goodness, he must have been wearing a blindfold in this fight. He had it 118-110 to Leonard, scored it by 8 rounds. To him. I mean, it wasn't that. It was a very close fight. I mean, I do think Leonard won on the night. You know, Gil Clancy had it 115-113 to Leonard. Ron Borges, who we both know from the Boston Globe, you know, writer you'd really respect, he had it to Hagler by a couple of points. Larry Merchant from HBO had it as a draw, and so on. I mean, I've written all this down, and the stats for that fight were Leonard threw 920 punches and landed 306 of them. Hagler threw 792 and landed 291. So, you know, there wasn't a heck of a lot in it. I mean, it's whether you liked Leonard's speed, and I think Hagler just didn't get started for 4 rounds. He gave the first 4 rounds of the fight away. He was outspeeded and made to look a bit slow, never really looked himself, worked his way into the fight, and probably started to land the more significant punches as it went on. But every time Leonard would match him with these little blitzes of punches to the body, you know, so there was never an impression of Hagler completely taking control in the way that he often did take control in his fights. And I just think he did give too much ground away early on, and that's why I think Leonard did just hold on. But Hugh McIlvany, I mean, would have given you a very, very long argument about it. He said those Leonard punches were just pitter-patter little punches, flashy ones for show, and the Hagler punches were proper, meaty, hurtful shots. Well, you know, a lot of other people saw something differently. But, I mean, I don't think it was a fantastic, classic thriller of a fight. I mean, some of the other fights between these four were ahead of that one, but as a news value fight, it was through the roof.
Hughie thought he conned, didn't he? He thought that Sugar Ray Leonard had conned his way to a victory. He was old school, wasn't he, Hughie? And he'd seen a lot of hard fights over the years, and he thought that Sugar Ray Leonard had just fooled the judges.
How did you score, John?
I thought Leonard won. I mean, yeah. I actually watched it again quite recently, and just sort of turned the commentary down and just watched the fight. And I agree with Ian. I thought Hagler did nothing significant in the early part of the fight. He came on strong, unquestionably, into the latter stages. But I just think that he'd given too much away, and I had it Leonard by a couple of points. I had it 115, 113.
Jim Murray, who used to write for the LA Times, I remember him writing. He said Leonard exposed Hagler. He made him look like a guy chasing his opponent down in snowshoes. I don't think it was like that really, but I kind of knew what he was talking about. I mean, you must have watched the fight, Tris, being the big boxing expert you are. What do you think?
Do you know, I've scored it, Ian, twice and at different times. So I've watched it many, many times, but I've scored it with pen and paper twice, years apart. And the first time I scored for Hagler, and the second time I scored for Leonard. And I think as I've grown a bit older, I look for different things. And I would have appreciated Marvin's marauding nature a little bit more the first time around. And I think years on, as I became a slightly more discerning fight fan, I think I appreciated Leonard's quality. But I think it's worth pointing out here, and I think it might have been Hugh that wrote this, John, is there was, I remember reading about it years ago, and it was obviously people worried about Leonard's health, didn't they, going into that fight because of the size difference, because Marvin was such a monster. And I think it was Hugh who wrote something like, basically every round that Leonard survived, you know, people were almost subconsciously scoring it for him because he'd finished on his feet and it was so much better than anyone thought he was going to do. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm obviously trying to set some sort of context here. And also there's that weird thing where obviously Hagler starts the fight in the orthodox stance, doesn't he?
Yeah. 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 And what that was all about, you know, I still wonder to this day. I guess he was just trying to literally wrong foot Leonard, wasn't he? But you know, it was mystifying.
I mean, Hagler was the 3-1 betting favorite to win the fight, so it was regarded as an upset. And you're right, Tris, there was a lot of talk because there'd been the detached retina stuff with Leonard, you know, there'd been the retirements, and you know, he hadn't fought really as a middleweight. I mean, another funny thing, I mean, it was one of the press conferences, and I stood up and said, oh, you know, on what basis, you know, if we're coming to it, is Sugar Ray Leonard fighting a middleweight? You know, how's he got the shot? And Aaron said, Rule 19. I said, what's that? He said, you do what the fuck you like. I mean, sorry, you should have to bleep that, but that, so I mean, yeah, it was, I mean, what an amazing era it all was, that. And yeah, we're guilty of wallowing in the nostalgia a bit too much about all of that, but it really was a great era for boxing.
Well, it's worth remembering as well. Sorry, it's worth remembering here as well that, you know, we talked about Leonard coming up from inactivity. Hagler had that bruising fight with John McGarvey, hadn't he?
Yeah.
And there were people saying that really, you know, that fight was that tough, that maybe Hagler wasn't the same guy with hindsight, having had that war with McGarvey.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably one of the reasons that Leonard decided this is now the time. This is the time when I could do it, because, you know, Ray'd done a lot of television commentary, and he'd seen maybe a deterioration in Hagler, and he'd probably reasoned that now was the right time, that moment was the time to prove that the boxing skills could beat the power of the man who had the natural middleweight skill. But you know, what I was going to say, Triz, and you know, you'd have some observations on this, I'm sure, is about Bob Arum. You know, he played a fantastic part in orchestrating all this series of super fights and getting them on to the extent that 40 years on, we're still talking about them.
Well, the thing is as well, Ian said at the top there, it's like Fury, Joshua, Usyk and Wilder all getting it on, you know, and then, but then it's also them having rematches and trilogies. I mean, it's astonishing the amount of fights. And I think, obviously, you've got to look at the whole cast as well. You've got Petronella, you've got Arcel, you've got Dundee, you've got Emmanuel Steward. Like, the supporting cast is super strong. And obviously, it is all chronicled in George Kimball's brilliant book. But there were some great writers around at the time. You've mentioned Ron Borge. You've mentioned Hugh McElveny. Like, just, it was just such a rich landscape, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, you mentioned Bob Arum, and credit to him. But of course, you know, he's a boxing promoter. So the kind of money being generated just for the Hagler-Leonard fight, that fight grossed, you know, way back in 1987, $78 million. Well, he paid Hagler $12 million and Leonard $11 million. Probably one of the very few times, if ever, that Leonard got the short end of the purse, but only by a little bit. And that was a nod in the direction of Hagler's long reign as middleweight champion. But, you know, work out the profit.
do you also remember from a financial perspective, though, Ian? Do you remember from a financial perspective that Hagler had done the deal on the pay-per-view? So he ended up massively out-earning Leonard for the fight. So I think in many ways he took it that he won. He might not have won the battle, but he won the war, because he finished up as the, you know, I know they would never have used this term back in the day, but as the A side, he was the guy that was laughing all the way to the bank. And I think his earnings, I might be wrong, but ended up nearer 20 million or even exceeded that.
I don't doubt it. I mean, and I remember, and I can still picture the scene now at the press conference after that fight, where Hagler, I mean, he never ever forgot what happened to him in Vegas with Anto Afermo, and never trusted Vegas judges again after that, even despite the fact that he'd had all those wins there subsequently to that. But he walked out with his entourage and said, "This is the last time you'll ever see me in this town, fighting in this town. It's the last time you'll ever see me fight." And he meant it. You know, he never came back. That was it. That was the end of it. And he went off to his acting career. And it's very sad. And I think we were all shocked to hear, you know, a guy who was super fit, and we remember him as hard as nails, you know, died at the age of 66.
Yeah, it was startling. Really hard to believe, Triz, that it was one of the truly shocking moments. I remember being told Marvin Hagler's passed. Yeah. And I found it hard to believe, because I'd seen him fairly recently prior to that, and he just looked so well. You know, I couldn't believe it.
He had that little spell, didn't he, where he commentated for the BBC. It might have been on the Audley Harrison fights or something like that, because the BBC hadn't been that involved in televised boxing. So I'm guessing it must have been that. And he was like the ringside summarizer, wasn't he? And he was good fun. I remember he laughed a lot, and he had a lot of personality on air.
John, answer me this: and why did, was it pride that stopped Hagler from returning, or was it just, as he'd said about that line about waking up in silk pajamas, did he just not need it anymore?
I suspect there might have been a little bit more of it, more to it than that. You know, I mean, fighters might not always recognize the fact that they're not once what they once were. You know, they can be delusional, but if they're brutally honest, they're the first ones to realize that things aren't quite happening as they once did. It would have hurt his ego losing that fight, and he went to the grave thinking that he'd won that fight. But I wonder if perhaps he also realized that at that stage of his career that his best days were behind him.
It's a difficult one, Ian, isn't it? Because, you know, we've all seen these guys walk away, but very few of them stay away for long. And Hagler, there just didn't seem to be any indication that he was interested in coming back at all. And obviously, you know, even if these guys had fought again, whether it was Leonard, whether it was Duran or Hearns, they would have always made money together.
Yeah, that's true. But I think it's a sign of how strong mentally Hagler was all the way through. I remember him saying when he was like halfway through his reign, and we asked him then, you know, how do you keep doing this? He said, "I might be the champion, but every time I get in that ring, I fight like the challenger, because I feel like all my life I've been a challenger. And that's how I'm going to keep on approaching it. So I just think he had that mental toughness. And I don't think it really would have entered his head to come back to the ring again. When he said he was done, he went out right at the top. Brilliant, well, really. Like Lennox did, you know, beating Klitschko. And look what Klitschko did after that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, obviously, now you mentioned Aram, and he's still the leading promoter in the sport now, aged 90 or 91. It's absolutely phenomenal, John. I bet you wouldn't have got much on a sweepstake with Bob Aram being the biggest promoter in the sport in 2023. But here's Aram. And I say, you know, we might have never had anything like the Fab Four since, but we did have Marquez, Pacquiao, Barrera, and Morales, and that sort of merry-go-round, although Marquez and Morales never fought. But John, as Ian said, we're guilty of being too nostalgic. Sometimes I think that there's actually scope for a Grumpy Old Men podcast, and I think we could actually give the currents today in the game both barrels every week. But where do you stand on that? I mean, is it nowhere near as good as it was? Or, you know, are these Halcyon days of the 80s just, you know, do we actually have them now with your Haneys, Lomachenkos, Garcias and Tanks, and we don't appreciate it? Or was it just a different time?
I think it was a different time. I think it was one of the very greatest of eras in that particular division, but perhaps in any division in the history of boxing. I think it was a great, great time, the 1980s. And I think we're absolutely right to revel in something very special. And if people watching, listening to this have not actually seen these fights, I really would recommend, you know, get back onto the computer, get it up on your TV, watch YouTube and see these fantastic fights, because they were very, very special. And I don't think we've had anything quite as good since.
Ian, easiest question then of the evening, rank them 1 to 4.
Oh, now you're asking the question, aren't you? I mean, right, it's amazing Bob Arum is still around, isn't it? And you wonder why he wants to still do it into his 90s. And he still gets angry every time everybody asks that question about, you know, did you really say, you know, yesterday I was lying, today I'm telling the truth. yeah. Okay, let's do it. Right. I'm going to go Leonard at number one. I think Leonard at number one, because he was like kind of like poetry watching him punch. I think he was just an amazing spectacle. And then I'd have to go Hagler 2. I think probably Duran 3 and Hearns 4, though I don't, you know, that's such a tight decision. You could argue that all day. It's a bit like the argument about Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi in football. You know, let's just say we were privileged to have those four around at the same time. I mean, and John's right. There'll probably never be anything quite like that again. It was magical. And yes, if you're one of our younger listeners, please go to YouTube and find those fights. You'll get a thrill.
Yeah, John, I'm going to have to ask you the same thing. Your four in order.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? You know, I hear what Ian said about Duran there, but 1984, on the back of Hearn's performance, he was made the Boxing Writers of America's Fighter of the Year for having smashed Roberto Duran in 2 rounds. You know, I think if it's difficult, isn't it? Because you're talking about different weight divisions, really. I think if you're talking about lightweights, I think Duran is clearly one of the greatest ever, you know, from the day he beat Buchanan all the way through to when he stepped up to fight at a higher weight. He was unquestionably the boss right the way through almost an entire decade in the 1970s. But, you know, if you're just talking about the appeal of the fighters, I think I'd probably go along with Ian's clarification. I think you've got to have Leonard at the top. Hagler, yeah, or the fact that he went so close to beating him when they finally fought, I suppose he's got to be number two. And then Hearn, based on the fact that he smashed Duran so totally, I'd have him 3 ahead of Duran.
Well, gents, thank you so much, as always, for joining me. We've probably left a little bit of meat on the bone on this discussion, so hopefully it's something that we can revisit, maybe with significant anniversaries or some such. But, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always. I know I say that absolutely every week, but people are enjoying this podcast. It's been fantastic to get some reviews in. We've got one from Marble S, who says, 5 stars, richly deserved to hear 3 people with a vast knowledge and love of the sport discuss current issues and share memories of the past. Buy it now. And then we've got one from C. Bram Bat. There's such a great podcast. Triss's knowledge and the incredible stories of Ian and John are a real joy. Great to hear Ian again after growing up listening to him on Sky Sports. He does add, sometimes the audio quality could be better. When you've got 3 hosts with a combined age of about 500, it's a struggle to work a Zoom, let alone focus on the quality. But we appreciate the feedback. And then I've got one from Rene Tungate, who says, this is fantastic and such a treat for boxing fans. Ian, John and Triss have formed a great partnership as they interact with one another, regaling us with their stories and experiences in the boxing world. Highly engaging. Very informative and funny too, especially Ian's priceless American accent. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to Ian and John, as ever. Thanks to you for listening, and we will be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Triss Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.